We'll hear argument first this morning in case 06969, Federal Election Commission versus Wisconsin Right to Life. In case 06970, Senator McCain versus Wisconsin Right to Life. General Clement.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, in McConnell against FEC, this Court upheld Title II's restrictions on electioneering communications by unions and corporations against facial attack. In doing so, this Court reviewed a voluminous record and concluded that the vast majority of the ads that had been run in previous cycles and came within the statutory definition could constitutionally be regulated by Congress. Accordingly, this Court rejected the overbreath challenge and upheld the statute on its face. Now, to be sure, the last time this case was before the Court made clear that nothing in McConnell foreclosed an opportunity for as-applied challenges to the statute, and the Court remanded the case for that purpose. But to be consistent with McConnell's overbreath decision, any as-applied challenge cannot have the effect of calling into question a substantial percentage of the statute's applications. Yet the district court's decision below has precisely that forbidden effect. There is nothing atypical about the three ads that are before this Court. Indeed, they closely resemble the Jane Doe hypothetical ads that this Court identified at page 127 as the prototype of ads that, although they took the form of issue ads, nonetheless were functionally equivalent to express advocacy.
Maybe we were wrong last time.
Well, Justice Scalia, I don't think you were wrong, and I suppose that obviously you thought the rest of the Court was wrong in McConnell, and if the Court wants to reconsider that decision, I mean, that's an option the Court can take in the appropriate case. I would suggest that this is not the appropriate case for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that I think it was briefed in this case really as something of an afterthought, not as a principal focus of the briefing. In the McConnell case, this Court, as you well remember, had an unbelievably exhaustive record before it in making a judgment about the facial constitutionality of the law.
We didn't have a concrete case such as this one, in which the assertions of the other side are very appealing as far as the rights of citizens to band together for an issue ad, even an issue ad that names somebody who's up for election within 90 days. We didn't have that appealing case before us. Now that we have it before us, and now that you tell us that this is a typical case, maybe we were wrong about the overbreath challenge before.
With respect, I don't think you were. And although you didn't have this case before you, you had many, many concrete cases before you that are really indistinguishable from this case. You had
how are we supposed to decide whether this case, if you think it's important to our resolution, how are we supposed to decide whether this particular case is typical or not?
Well, I mean, I guess it's hard for me to say how you would decide whether it's typical.
Well,
I'm not sure that's the question.
I think it's very hard to determine. Therefore, I think it's hard to determine in the abstract whether it's inconsistent with the conclusion in McConnell that a vast majority of the cases would not be covered or if it's inconsistent with it.
Well, Mr. Chief Justice, let me try to come at it this way, which is to say I would have thought that if you're not going to overturn McConnell, you're just going to apply it and say, well, what kind of as-applied challenges are left? I would have thought that what you would have in mind is ads that had an identifiable characteristic that marked them as being outside of the mainstream and somehow different from most of the ads. And
well,
so
it gets back to my same question. How do we know that this is or is not outside the mainstream? We have just the three ads that are at issue here. It's not as if we have a survey of all the ads that are run during the blackout periods in particular election cycles. How can we tell whether this is within the mainstream or not?
One strong indicator that these are in the mainstream is how close they are to the Jane Doe hypothetical that this Court identified as the prototype of the kind of ads that, although they took the form of issue ads, they looked like issue ads, they really were indistinguishable from and the functional equivalent of express advocacy.
General Clement, that Jane Doe ad was in the record last time. There were others, weren't there, the issue?
There were hundreds. I mean, as you well remember, there were hundreds of ads in the record, and this Court was able to draw conclusions about them both by looking at some of the specifics but also looking at the forest, if you will. And one of the things they recognized, for example, is that these ads weren't turning up uniformly wherever issues were being debated. these ads were turning up in the close elections, in the close races.
The court in McConnell used the term, as you've used this morning, vast majority. What is that? Is 70% a vast majority? So that 30% of the ads are going to be outside of that and would be candidates for this as-applied challenge?
Well, no, Mr. Chief Justice, because the court used vast majority, and I mean, you know, that could mean 70%, it could mean 80%, it could mean 90%. Equally importantly, on page 207 of the opinion, when it was specifically addressing overbreath, it made the argument and made the conclusion that both in absolute and relative terms, this statute was not substantially overbroad. And it seems to me then, at a minimum, for any as-applied challenge to be consistent with that overbreath determination, it can't have the effect of opening up the statute wide open, such that on a going-forward basis, the majority, certainly a substantial number, percentage, inconsistent with an overbreath holding, of the ads that would be run by unions and corporations within the last 60 days of the election would qualify for the exception. That just seems inconsistent with the overbreath holding.
Did that statement refer only to issue ads, or did it refer to all ads?
It referred to all ads that would come within the statutory prohibition.
Right. And here we are dealing with a subset of all ads, and that is issue ads. So that statement doesn't necessarily speak to whether, you know, a vast majority of all issue ads have to be.
But with respect, Justice Scalia, there were so many issue ads in the record in McConnell that if issue ads were an appropriate category for as-applied challenges, it would have been impossible for this Court to reject the substantial
overbreath. So long as that statement applied to the totality of ads, many of which were ads just directed at defeating particular candidates, I don't see how you can say that we're bound by that statement.
Well, Justice Scalia, the only other obvious candidate that you could carve out would be express advocacy, and the Court was clear in footnote 18 of the opinion what percentage that was, 4 to 5%. So as to the 95% of the ads that didn't engage in express advocacy, this Court still had no difficulty concluding that the vast majority of them were within Congress's conception of the purposes of the statute.
Everything that is not express advocacy is an issue ad. Are those the world is divided into express advocacy and issue ads?
I mean, that's one way to divide it. I mean, you're using the term issue ad. I don't think,
I wouldn't divide it that way. I would think there are a lot of express advocacy ads. I think there are a lot of non-express advocacy ads that are not issue ads.
Justice Scalia, you're using the term issue ad as if it's self-defining. I don't view it that way. And, I mean, even Apelli has tried to narrow it to grassroots lobbying. Now, of course, there's a problem with the grassroots lobbying argument, and that is it was made to this Court in McConnell. And at that time, the nature of the argument wasn't, oh, grassroots lobbying, that's a sort of idiosyncratic or atypical application that would give rise to a narrow as-applied exception. No, the argument there, and a great illustration is Apelli's national affiliate, National Right to Life, at pages 6 and 7 of their reply brief in McConnell. They argued about grassroots lobbying, and they said, boy, this statute applies to grassroots lobbying. Therefore, it's substantially overbroad.
Seems to me you're suggesting the district court decision is inconsistent with McConnell, but it seems that your approach today is inconsistent with our decision last year that you can have as-applied challenges. You're suggesting that if we allow this as-applied challenge to go forward, that we have to facially strike down the section.
Oh, Mr. Chief Justice, I'm not saying that, and my point is that not all as-applied challenges are created equal.
So tell me what an ad that would succeed in an as-applied challenge looks like, or what the standard would be that we would apply in a way that you think would not call into question the decision in McConnell about Section 203.
Well, let me give you a couple of examples of look, my job is to defend the constitutionality of the statute on its face and as applied. So I'm not suggesting that any of these as applied challenges would necessarily succeed, or I wouldn't be up here trying to make some argument in defense of the statute.
What you're saying, though, is if this as applied challenge succeeds, you're saying the only way we can do that is if we think that the statute is facially unconstitutional.
Well,
I'm just trying to see if there's a way of approaching this as-applied challenge in a way that doesn't require us to revisit that prior.
Absolutely.
It doesn't help your case with me, at least, for you to tell us that it is your job to say that no as-applied challenge will suffice.
Well, then let me give
That doesn't inspire me with confidence in what you're telling us.
Well, let me give you some inspirational as-applied challenges that would be better as-applied challenges than this one. a challenge by a 501c3 corporation that has difficulty setting up a separate segregated fund, much better as-applied challenge. The challenge that was brought in the main case that you have before you in another petition or another appeal, that was a challenge to an ad that was run in an unopposed primary. That starts to sound like a pretty good as-applied challenge.
There's a claim here that there was a difficulty in setting up a fund in time to do what had to be done with respect to this issue, which was a distinctive issue that had come up, and they said we didn't have time to set up a separate PAC that would effectively meet the problem. Why isn't that distinctive enough?
With respect, Justice Scalia, it would be a better case if that were the claim. There's no doubt that Apelli has a PAC, a separate segregated fund. So their claim isn't that they didn't have one. Their claim is that it was underfunded vis-a-vis what it would cost to fund these ads. But that itself is clearly a conscious decision, because if you look at how much money they had in their PAC in 2000, they had $155,000 or something like that in their PAC, plenty to pay for this ad. This time around, they had $13,000. Now, why is that? It's pretty clear from the record that they shifted their emphasis not to getting money for their PAC, but to get money in their general corporate treasury to fund these ads. And so they raised $300 million in corporate funds. But that doesn't make this a good as-applied challenge.
Can I understand you to suggest that we ought to draw a distinction in as-applied challenges between a 501c3 organization and a corporation?
I think a 501c3 corporation has a much better as-applied challenge if they can bring it. And that's the as-applied challenge that's sort of been discussed in some of the amicus briefs. The problem is Apelli's not in a position to do that because they're a 501c4 corporation. Another example of a better challenge would be the Chief Justice's hypothetical from the earlier argument, which would be a corporation that runs a series of ads and then wants to continue to run them during the election cycle. Well, that's not this case, but it well could be. The filibuster issue isn't something that came like a bolt out of the blue on the eve of the election. Throughout 2003, there were filibusters in the Senate on a pretty regular basis.
I think it's accepted that the public only tunes in to the political dialogue shortly before the election. That's the time in which you reach the public. So the fact that the filibuster has been going on for a long time is, I don't think, answers the question as to how speech can be the most effective.
Well, Justice Kennedy, you may be right that certainly people do tend to focus on issues in the context of an election. But I think the record in this case does not bear out the conclusion that people only care about them at those times, or that groups don't bother running ads at other times. And if you look at the 2005 time frame, the record reflects that a number of groups, not Apelli, but a number of groups, had issue ads addressing the filibuster issue. And what's interesting about that to me is if you look at Joint Appendix 45 and 46 for the examples, they were able to do it in terms with the tagline, "Urge call the Senate." And if Apelli had run those same ads, which would capture the issue, then they wouldn't have even come within the statute. So it does illustrate both that this is an issue that drew enough public interest to generate ads at different time periods, not just in the re-election context. And even when it did that, it was possible to engage on the issue without coming within the confines of the statute. So it just seems like —
Are there frequent instances in the political process, do you think, in which the public runs an ad against a candidate, knowing the candidate is probably going to win anyway? He or she's from a safe district or right ahead in the polls. But they want to run the ad anyway in order to affect his conduct or her conduct once they're reelected, so that they'll take a different position, a second look. It seems to me logically that's possible. I just don't know if that happens very often.
Justice Kennedy, it's certainly possible. I don't think it's common, though, and the reason I say that is just to go back to the record in McConnell. The one thing the record there made pretty clear is that when you got to the period 60 days before the election, these ads were not being ran in a way that would have some random distribution that you might expect if they were just interested in the issues or just interested uniformly in all re-elections. These ads were really concentrated in the close districts. I mean, one of the lines that sticks out in my mind from the record is in trying to fund money for these so-called issue ads, the Club for Growth executive said, we need money for these issue ads because they make all the difference in close elections.
Well, now but yes, it may make the difference in a close election, but it is also likely to be more effective with regard to the senator whose vote you won on the issue. Are you going to waste your money in those districts where the senator is not going to vote the way you want, no matter what? The situation you pose is precisely the one where you would want your issue ad to run.
Well, Justice Scalia, if your point is that there may be an interest in trying to leverage the upcoming election to try to get somebody's attention, I think that's
probably — To get the senator's attention.
Sure.
The senator who is at risk is likely to listen. The senator who has a safe seat is not.
No doubt that's true, but I think it also implicates the interest of Congress and the statute that this Court recognized and upheld on its face. When the whole point is, we're not just interested in this issue in the abstract, and we're not running this issue just because there's a pending vote in Congress. We're interested in running this ad because it's a pretty effective vehicle, both to defeat this candidate's reelection chances, but if we don't succeed on that, maybe we'll convince him to change his mind.
But you can't tell which of the two they had in mind, whether they wanted the senator defeated or they wanted to put enough pressure on the senator that he would change his vote with regard to the filibuster. I would think that the latter is more likely the motive than the former.
Well,
and why do you assume the worst?
I don't know. The fact that by the time they ran these ads, Senator Feingold had voted 20 times out of 20 to filibuster suggests to me that they probably concluded that the best way to get a Wisconsin senator who wouldn't filibuster was to change senators, not to change Senator Feingold's mind.
What about the relevance of this same group having strongly opposed Feingold every time he ran for election? It was no secret that they were opposed to his candidacy.
No, that's absolutely right, Justice Ginsburg. And obviously the statute itself and its clear bright-line test doesn't make you get into those kind of inquiries. But if their claim is to come into court and say, well, we had a pure heart. We didn't have an intent to affect
this,
the election.
This is the First Amendment. We don't make people guess whether their speech is going to be allowed by Big Brother or not. If you are going to cut off the speech, there ought to be a clear line, not whether I had against Feingold in the past or whether Feingold voted 20 times against this or half of the time against this. It seems to me you need a clear First Amendment line, and you're not giving us any.
Sure I am, Justice Scalia. I'm giving you the statute on its face, which couldn't be clearer. If you want to have as-applied exceptions, if you want to go down the road to, quote, the Chief Justice in dissent in MCFL of creating barely adumbrated exceptions, you may inject some vagueness. Now, that may be necessary, and there may be as-applied challenges out there that do the trick without creating vagueness. But I don't think this is the one. And just because the first as-applied challenge you see is a problematic one doesn't mean there aren't better as-applied challenges out there. If I could reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you, General Clement. Mr. Waxman?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I'd like to address three points that came up at the earlier part of the argument. First of all, I'd like to, I think just with respect, correct a premise of one of Justice Scalia's questions. Then I would like to address the two questions that I think I heard the Chief Justice ask, which is, how do we know that this is an atypical ad, and what standard would a court apply in adjudicating as-applied challenges? And then finally, assuming there's time permitting, I'd like to address the question of why we shouldn't revisit McConnell, which I think was posed both by the Chief Justice and by Justice Scalia. First, as to the premise, Justice Scalia, and it relates to what the predicate was of the now famous vast majority reference. I'm quoting from it, it's entirely clear from this Court's opinion, and I believe it's on page 207, that the referent was issue ads. In fact, what this Court said was, the precise percentage of issue ads that clearly identified a candidate and were aired during those relatively brief pre-election time spans but had no electioneering purpose is a matter of dispute between the parties and among the judges on the district court. Nevertheless, the vast majority of ads clearly had such a purpose.
Is that your test, if it has any electioneering purpose?
We think the test is whether or not it is, as this Court indicated, I think, whether it's the functional equivalent of express advocacy. It doesn't use the magic words, but does it have the same effect? That is the test that this Court should — not this Court — a district court adjudicating an as-applied challenge that is based on the content of the ad, not the sort of as-applied challenge that was brought in MCFL or Brown versus the Socialist Workers' Parties that relate to the nature of the speaker, but one that's based on the content, requires the challenger to show, okay, in a context of a statute that is facially valid and can constitutionally be applied to the vast majority of ads that are covered by the definition of electioneering communications, he needs to come in and show that with respect to this ad, it has characteristics such that no reasonable voter could view it as promoting, attacking, supporting, or opposing.
Do we usually place the burden when we're applying strict scrutiny under the First Amendment on the challenger to prove that they're allowed to speak as opposed to the government to prove to carry the burden that they can censor the speech?
I think the rule is quite clear that you never do that. This strict scrutiny clearly applies here, but in the context of the application of a statute that has already been upheld as facially constitutional in the vast majority of applications, the government doesn't have the burden of reconvincing the district court the very things that the Supreme Court has already decided.
That vast majority thing, was that the holding of the case? Every word that we uttered in that prior case is law? I mean, am I free to think, is a lower court free to think that maybe it's really not the vast majority? But just because we said vast majority, it's like writing it in a statute.
We would have an awful lot of laws if everything that you wrote constituted law and a holding. That statement and a statement that follows shortly after it on the following page were essential to this Court's decision that applying the strictest possible scrutiny, this law was very narrowly tailored.
The test as to any ad is whether any reasonable person could view the ad as an electioneering ad?
An electioneering ad, Justice Scalito, I think puts too much of a burden on
it. Any reasonable person could view it as what?
What a district court would say is, could a reasonable voter in the targeted electorate have understood that this ad was, in part, promoting, attacking, supporting, or opposing the acronym?
Let's say a group has long had ads on a particular issue. And let's say a particular candidate's position on the issue is very well known to people who pay attention to public affairs. And let's say we're within the blackout period and now an important vote is coming up in Congress on that very issue. If the group continues to run the ad on that issue, that a reasonable person could view that as saying something about the election, couldn't it?
I would think so.
That would be prohibited?
Well, it would depend on as your question suggests, on the context in which the ad is run. Now, I want to make two points with respect to your inquiry. Number one, as this Court has reiterated, we're not talking about a ban here. Any one of these ads can be run so long as it is funded the same way that the election law requires them all to be funded.
What do you make of the fact that there's so many advocacy groups that say this is really impractical?
I love it. And I'm going to give you the ACLU as an example because their brief is quite powerful. They and the other amici who provide a groaning table of amicus briefs every time this issue comes up have never, ever, ever brought their own as-applied challenge, although these groups are not shy to litigate when they think important rights are in effect. There have been, in the 3 years since this Court decided McConnell, and in the year since this Court made clear what I think we had assumed, which is this statute is open season on as-applied challenges. There have been precisely two as-applied challenges brought, both brought by the counsel in this case. The ACLU's brief, which is as representative as any other, says, look at these ads that we've been running about really important issues, the war in Iraq, Guantanamo, et cetera, et cetera. Here is the text of the ad. If we had put onto a tagline of that ad, please call Senator so-and-so and tell him no, we wouldn't be allowed to do it. Well, you know what? With one exception that I'll explain in a minute, in its 90-year history, the ACLU has never, way before BCRA was passed, even outside the 60-day period, they never put that line on. And you know why? It's because they have pledged to their members and to the public that they will not engage in electioneering of any sort. They are completely nonpartisan, and they don't ever want to be understood to the contrary. And so they never include those words.
Other groups think it's an important part of their exercise of First Amendment rights to petition their senators and congressmen and to urge others to, as in these ads, contact your senators, contact your congressmen. Just because the ACLU doesn't do that doesn't seem particularly pertinent to me.
Well, no, I mean, I think it does demonstrate a few things. First of all, it is entirely possible, as this Court reiterated in McConnell, for this exact same message or an equally effective message to be given at any particular time. If the ACLU or the National Rifle Association or any of the other groups that never wants to actually bring an as-applied challenge but always wants to say, oh, no, 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 this is horrible, wants to run an ad, as this Court isn't, they can establish a separate segregated fund, and if they come in and convince a court that that's impractical or impossible, maybe they get an as-applied challenge.
Is this true of the NRA also? Is it the case that they have never targeted, so to speak, a particular legislator?
I don't think anybody would claim that, even Mr. Cooper,
who I'm confident is. So why pick on the ACLU?
I don't mean to pick on the ACLU. I think highly of both organizations and many of the amici that are arrayed against me. The point is that I use the ACLU as an example because the reason they never name a congressman is because they don't want their ads to be perceived as breaking faith with what they tell the public. As for the NRA, the NRA actually did bring a challenge against the FEC in the D.C. Circuit and said, we don't really qualify under MCFL because we take some corporate funds, but it's de minimis, and we think that's what the Supreme Court had in mind. And you know what? They won. But they can't take yes for an answer. They want to establish that this law is facially unconstitutional. And that does go to the point, I think, if I may, as to why you shouldn't re-examine McConnell from first principles. But let me just say, in response to your very first question, Mr. Chief Justice, that the reason that we know that this ad is typical is, as this Court articulated the paradigm of an electioneering communication that constitutes the Jane Doe example. And this case is materially indistinguishable from the Jane Doe ad, that is one that, quote, condemns Jane Doe's record on a particular issue before exhorting viewers to call Jane Doe. Here we've got an ad that denounced the, quote, group of senators who had filibustered judicial nominees. May I finish my sentence? The only thing that distinguishes that statement from Jane Doe is knowing that Senator Feingold was part of that group. And reasonable listeners in the context of the ad itself and the website would certainly have known that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Waxman. Mr. Bott?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. I think the government's problem here is that they are repudiating the very studies and expert witness testimony that this Court relied upon in recognizing a distinction between sham issue ads and genuine issue ads. That was a methodology that the government created, and this Court relied upon. Now they are converting genuine issue ads, which they identified in the record through their expert testimony and their studies. These ads are contained in the joint appendix on pages 159 to 167. Their expert, based upon their studies, testified that these were genuine issue ads. Now, they refuse to state, as they do here, refuse to state, a test to determine what's a genuine ad. So we are left trying to comply with this law and mount the as-applied challenges that this Court said is available to us to look at these ads and determine what essential features there are of these ads. And as I will explain further later, these are grassroots lobbying ads of the type, not like Jane Doe or Yellowtail, but exactly the type of the PBA ad, for instance, which we have focused on, which is on page 166 of the Joint Appendix. So in these studies, and these experts, they only looked at the text of these ads to determine whether they were genuine or sham. There was no testimony about the subjective intent of the speaker. There was no testimony about the particular groups who ran these ads on whether or not their PAC was supporting a particular candidate. No expert in McConnell speculated about the possible effect of any particular ad to determine whether it was genuine or sham.
I rather like the one we had before about Senator Fairclough. And his ad was, Senator Fairclough is against the trial lawyers and their efforts to increase liability laws. So write him.
Yes.
Now, testimony all over the place. That is the advocacy candidate ad of the century. And you couldn't possibly know that without having known that one of the parties had spent millions trying to paint Fairclough's opponent, Senator Edwards, as the creature of the trial lawyers. But anyone in North Carolina knew it. So they read those words, and they understand precisely what's at stake. They're saying, vote against Edwards, vote for Fairclough. Now, you just tell me how anyone could know such a thing without looking at the context.
There was no testimony in McConnell that that ad, for those that determined whether or not it was sham or genuine, that ad was sham or genuine. There was no testimony, no reference in the expert
report. I thought people offered to bring in such facts as, there is a website address here. It says, indeed, oddly, don't phone the senator. Go look at the website. And if you look at that website, it says, defeat him, defeat him, defeat him. I mean, that sounds as if they have defeat in mind.
Certainly
there are about four or five things which they said to look at outside the four corners. So I'm not certain what it is in the law that says that you only look to the four corners. I mean, I read the opinion below. Did you read, by the way, the 1,000-page opinion? I bet you did. The 1,000-page opinion of the district court?
I did, indeed.
Good. Then you know, like I know, and it took me a week, and it probably took you less, but you know what that record was like in the case, don't you?
Yeah.
Thousands and thousands of pages that, as I read it, I drew one conclusion. The one conclusion was, if there's a law, and it's a good law under the Constitution, if it is, that corporations and labor unions cannot give money to political campaigns, and if it is true, as it is true, that what political campaigns are about now is television, and if it is true, as it is true, that these are the single lion's share, the single best way to get somebody defeated or elected, then if you open the gates and say corporations and rich givers or whatever can contribute by writing these ads and paying for them, forget the first two premises. Forget the rule that says corporations can't contribute. Now, I put all that in front of you because it seems to me what you're asking for is for us to overturn McConnell and to say, either in practice or in theory, McCain-Feingold campaign finance law is unconstitutional.
You are asking for that, among other things, aren't you?
Well, if there's no workable test.
And you are asking for nothing else.
If there is no workable test that is reasonably ascertainable by small grassroots organizations that separates genuine issue ads from sham issue ads. This court in Ashcroft said you cannot throw out the protected speech in order to target unprotected speech. And the line of argumentation that the government is presenting simply ignores the fact that at least we have a dilemma. Mm-hmm. We have Congress in session during the blackout periods voting on items, and we have in the First Amendment one of the four indispensable freedoms, your right to petition the government.
But and I agree with you that exactly what Justice Scalia said. If we agree with you in this case, goodbye, McCain-Feingold. Maybe we should do it up front. That's what you advocate. Very well. Will you address that? Why should this Court, only a year or two after it upholds McCain-Feingold, accept the position that either in fact or in theory overturns that case?
Because facial upholdings can only be sustained constitutionally if as-applied challenges are adequate to protect the protected speech. And this case demonstrates that is probably impossible. It is certainly demonstrating that when the government has changed its criteria, it is using criteria that it rejected previously, now to say genuine issue ads, which we asked this court to rely upon in their testimony and studies as genuine issue ads, that they are repudiating those.
Why do you say that those issue ads are inconsistent with the government's position here?
Well, because they because
you haven't explained that.
Yes, the Wisconsin Right to Life ads are in every material respect indistinguishable from these six grassroots lobbying ads.
You're taking this because on a four corners facial criterion.
Yes, I think
one of the issues in this case is whether that is an appropriate methodology. So,
well this court is consistent.
We address that.
Well, this court has consistently rejected the idea of looking to outside the message of the speaker, such as subjective intent or.
We're not talking about subjective intent here. We're talking about what Justice Breyer raised a moment ago, and that is, we are looking for the public political context in which the ad is run. He gave the example of the Faircloth Edwards ads. Anyone in North Carolina knew what they meant. Someone in Idaho or New Hampshire probably did not, because they did not know the context. Your argument, it seems to me, is ignore the context. And my question is, why should we do that?
Well, that test that has been articulated by the government would invite ads to be prohibited based upon the varied understandings of the listener.
Doesn't any communication depend upon the understanding of the listener? Can we even sensibly talk about what a statement means or an advertisement means without understanding the context in terms of the listener's understanding?
You do that all the time. Based upon the test is what do the words say? What does the ad say?
The question is, what do the words mean?
Yes, what do they mean?
It is impossible to know what the words mean without knowing the context in which they are spoken.
When the government put these exhibits, were those exhibits complete with context?
No, there was
no. I didn't think so. They just put what the ads were.
They did two big studies in 98 and 2000. And there was absolutely no testimony about
My question is, why should we ignore the context? How can we tell what something means without the context?
Well, there is relevant context, such as the person named, the incumbent, is a candidate. That would be a relevant context. It is broadcast within 60 days of a general election in which he is a candidate as well as a voting member of the Senate. That it would be context.
But those don't go to meaning in the sense of, for example, the Faircloth Edwards example does. Why should we ignore the aspects of context which determine meaning, i.e. the understanding that a listener would have?
Because it would prohibit all speech because no one would know in advance whether or not there would be
You mean the people in North Carolina were unaware of the Edwards position? They were unaware of the distinction between Faircloth and Edwards?
Of course they knew that.
And just as presumably, you knew the position of Senator Feingold in these advertisements, and the people in the state knew because of your other public statements.
Because of one or two press releases?
Why should those things be ignored?
There's absolutely no evidence that anyone in Wisconsin knew his position on the filibuster.
Do you think they're dumb?
You have a website that
calls their attention, and you think nobody's going to it?
Well, we can't run the ads.
No one is paying attention to what the senator is doing.
If we can't run the ads, we can't draw people's attention.
You think the only source of information about Senator Feingold is your advertisement?
No, but I don't think.
Then, if your advertisement is not the sole source of information, why do you assume that no one in Wisconsin knows what the senator has been doing when he votes?
Look, polls show that a majority of the people don't even know who the vice president of the United States is. So to suggest that they know
so the
particular
position. So your
argument
is that we ignore context because the voters aren't smart enough to have a context?
No, that we be allowed to speak so we can give that information to the voters.
But that's the point. Because that's where I get into my chain. You have an argument. I'm not denying that. I understand it. But it's sort of, for me, deja vu all over again. We've heard it.
Yeah, but you said there were genuine
And what happened before, either you can distinguish this, which I don't see how, frankly, or you're back into the chain. And if you want to say one more thing about the chain, I didn't draw it to the final ending there. If I think most of the ads, and that's what that caller could tell me, opinion was about. That's what that 1,000-page record is about. That's what the 10,000 pages of testimony were about. That's what McCain-Feingold was about. And all those witnesses, they said in today's world, these are the kinds of ads people run to defeat people. And then they said, moreover, most of the campaign money goes on them. And then they said, moreover, if you let corporations and labor unions contribute to these, well, then they can contribute to the campaign. And the only thing I left out before was, if you're prepared to say the Constitution requires us to let corporations and unions buy these kinds of ads, well, how could it be constitutional to have a statute that forbids them to contribute directly to the candidate? Well, something that's been in existence only since, I guess, 1904. But how could that be constitutional if they can just give this money directly? Why can't they give this same money to the candidate?
Well, because your decision in Beaumont, which creates a distinction between contributions and independent speech, and this is independent speech.
It's pretty easy to tell whether you're giving the money to the candidate or not, isn't it?
Very readily.
It's a fairly bright line that you don't have to worry about stepping over the wrong side of it. Whereas this one, especially if you adopt a context determination that requires a 1,000-page district court opinion, who knows?
Well, is that right? I mean, what we have here is we happen to have three criteria, absolutely clear. Does it mention the candidate? Does it run within 30 or 60 days before the election? And is it targeted to an electorate? Now, that's clear. Now, if you're prepared to say, that's unclear. I don't understand it. You don't need a 1,000-page record about that. All you need is a record where you have your organization to come in and show how yours is significantly different from the mine run of cases.
The problem is you're not giving force to the all other conclusion of all three district court judges that there were genuine issue ads.
Oh, yes, I say.
Of the grassroots lobbying type. And that these ads have fall under a different line of cases. First National Bank versus Bilotti has held that corporate efforts to influence legislative and executive branch officials.
Are you trying to convince us the purpose of these ads was to convince Senator Feingold to change his position on filibusters?
It was indeed. It was to lobby him about the upcoming vote.
Did you think that was a realistic goal?
Yes, as it turns out. Because in 2006, we ran the same sort of anti-filibuster ads, and Senator Cole, now up for re-election, changed his position on the filibuster. So these things happen. In other words, people's positions are affected by grassroots lobbying, and at least people should have the opportunity to engage in grassroots lobbying.
Is that called democracy?
I'm sorry. We are hopeful, Your Honor, and that our system of self-government is based upon the self-government of the people and their ability to influence the actions of governmental officials.
Mr. Bopp, your argument that McConnell's facial holding should be overturned appears on page 62 of your brief. I take it you have at least 61 pages arguing that your as-applied challenge can succeed without overturning McConnell's decision?
Yes, we have, and which would require the adoption of a reasonably ascertainable test, one that people would not be subject to 3 years of litigation, scorched earth, litigation tactics, intrusive discovery into every aspect of their organization for decades. It would have to be clear, simple, and objective, and be able to be implemented on short notice because things pop up, like the filibuster of a Supreme Court nominee in January of 2006.
What's your test? Their test is fuzzy. I agree with you. What's yours? You have a clear one?
Well,
that does not invalidate the whole statute?
Well, based on their evidence in McConnell and these grassroots, genuine issue ads, I think there are three key or essential features of those ads that we are satisfied would protect grassroots lobbying and genuine issue ads. The first is based upon the content of the communication. They focus on a current legislative matter, take a position on it, urge people to contact them, their congressmen and senators, to take a particular action or position. Secondly,
that says what's good. What is your test for what's bad?
Second, the ads do not mention an election, candidacy, political party, challenger, or the official's character, qualifications, or fitness for office. That was the key link the district court found, that these ads were not, as Buckley said, and of course McConnell was litigated under Buckley, is that they were not unambiguously candidate-related.
But that's all right, give us a third one. I want to go back to that.
The third one is, as long as the ad meets this pattern, that the fact that the ad, ours does not, but the fact that the ad mentions the name or the position of a public official on an issue and praises or criticizes him or her for that does not affect its genuineness.
Okay, may I go back to your second criterion? It seems to me that your second criterion is simply the injection of magic words back again. You're saying if we don't use certain magic words, it's okay.
Well,
that's a magic words test.
You're not looking for any particular word. You're looking for the meaning and thrust of the item.
No, but you said if we don't mention the election and the candidacy of this person for the election, that is one of the conditions with the other three, which would be sufficient to justify the on First Amendment grounds, justify running the ad. That seems to me simply to be re-injecting magic words in a negative form.
Well, in a much more expansive and comprehensive test, which looks to three features of the ad, but in any event, you look at the words all the time. Is it fighting words? You look at what are the words? Well, what are they said?
We look at fighting words in a context.
And I think we have a relative.
Say something in a biker's bar and another thing in an exclusive club.
And I think we have a relevant context.
Are there many cases where we look just at the words?
Well, you certainly have.
Fire in the crowded theater. It has to be crowded theater.
Well, relevant context, that there's an election upcoming, so it's within 60 days, the person's a candidate. These are relevant, and for that matter, whether the matter is a current legislative branch matter or likely to arise in the near future.
Mr. Bopp, you do not have to establish, do you, that the test you propose will get at every bad ad, that it will be sure to get at every ad that is not a genuine issue ad? Is that the burden on you?
I don't believe so.
I thought
so,
when we're dealing with the First Amendment, we give wide scope to the principle that it is better to allow some bad speech than it is, in the effort to get rid of that bad speech, to eliminate any good speech that is justified. So even if there is something that might sneak through does achieve what Congress didn't want to achieve, the answer in the First Amendment is that's too bad. There's some stuff you just can't get at. There's a lot of bad speech that is allowed all the time because you can't get at it without suppressing the good speech.
I think that's the standard.
I thought the First Amendment totally on one side. Isn't this a case where the courts held that there are various significant constitutional interests on both sides of the equation, which is what makes this kind of thing difficult?
Giving meaning to one side was upholding it facially. Now your job is to give meaning to the other side, which is genuine issue ads that are to be protected as.
I'm just suggesting why a pure First Amendment test doesn't necessarily answer the question and why we've upheld McCain-Feingold.
But even if you use balancing, you've already used it. That you upheld it on its face because you said a vast majority were shams. At the same time, you said there were genuine issue ads. You reserved the question of whether or not the interest is sufficient, the governmental interest is sufficient to prohibit genuine issue ads in footnote 88. You know, they refused to give a test. They refused to tell us what is the standard.
But your test changed.
Your
test, as I understand it, is the test to determine whether you fall within this sort of heartland of the statute which we upheld on facial challenge. Yours is a test for exclusion from the facial rule. Isn't that correct? That was why you were giving the answer to Justice Scalia that you gave?
I did not.
In other words, you're saying, I have three criteria, and if I satisfy those criteria, then the facial validity of the statute is not an answer to my claim. That's basically what you're saying. And,
yes.
Of course, if you succeed in that, you're saying, okay, the government then has a burden of satisfying strict scrutiny. That's the reason for your test, isn't it? To get you out of McCain-Feingold? I mean, to get you out of the holding in McConnell.
We're not trying to get out of the holding in McConnell.
Sure, you're saying this is an applied challenge which is different in some relevant respect, so that the facial holding in McConnell shouldn't apply to us. It shouldn't justify the government in barring our ad. Isn't that your logic?
You could say yes to that.
Thank you.
You want to go further than that, I know, but that's your first step.
That's what you were getting. Our first step is we want to give meaning to the promise of McConnell, that there were genuine issue ads that could be protected by as-applied
challenge. And the way to do that is to say there's something different about my case from the case which was taken as typical in upholding the statute against facial challenge.
He fears the Greeks even when they bear gifts.
Yes, we have. We have demonstrated how these ads are materially identical to the genuine issue ads this government presented to this court, and you relied upon that representation. We have demonstrated why, and their experts have agreed that the Yellowtail ad, the Jane Doe ad, is completely different than our ads. Their experts say that our ads are grassroots lobbying ads. Now, we are faced with a change in position of the government. I mean, in McConnell, the government said naming a candidate is critical. Now their experts say it doesn't matter if you name a candidate or not. Any genuine issue, any ad, can influence an election if you mention an issue.
Your principal concern at this point is getting yourself out from the holding of McConnell. In other words, by saying, we have a case which was not the typical case in McConnell. That's why it's an as-applied challenge, and that's why this is a new ballgame. And I take it your principal argument for that in criticizing the government's position is that the government didn't used to say that there's something significant or something insignificant about naming the candidate, and now they do. That, it seems to me, if I understand your argument, goes back to this context argument or not. Because the argument that's being made is, in context, we know perfectly well what's going on.
I just think
and
that
you're saying you shouldn't look at the context.
I think that simply misstates the effect of this ad. If anybody wanted to influence an election about with this ad, this is the most remote, attenuated, speculative
way. Why did you refer them to the website? There's nothing remote or speculative about what happens when they look at the website.
And that has been also misstated in the briefing here. There was absolutely nothing on that website about anything other than the filibuster issue. There was nothing about the PAC or what the PAC was doing. It was all about the filibuster.
Anything about Senator Feingold?
Well, of course. It was about Senator Feingold's position. It was the one change.
Did the website indicate the Wisconsin Right to Life's position on Senator Feingold?
Only on the filibuster. Yes. It identified, the ads don't, the website does identify the position of Senator Feingold on the filibuster and criticizes him for that. Now, if that is to be, you know, number one, the whole First Amendment was adopted to allow.
That's part of the context, isn't it? In other words, you're supplying some context for the ad. You're saying if you want to know the context in which we're saying this, look at the website.
No, we don't believe that that's
you
part of the context.
You don't think that's what you're doing?
The FEC doesn't even regulate what's on the Internet. You can do anything you want.
The FEC doesn't regulate anything else in the broader political context except what the statute allows. My point is, it seems to me you're referring to context. Why, therefore, is it illegitimate for a court to look to context?
We have not referred to context. We are not importing in our analysis.
May I ask this rather basic question? Do you agree that the Constitution permits Congress to pass a statute that prohibits your using electioneering ads that use magic words?
Yes.
And would it also prohibit you from using, urging everyone to look to a website that uses the same magic words?
Would it?
Yes.
Perhaps, yes.
So that if your website used the magic words, then your ad could be regulated.
You're talking about the constitutionality of a federal statute that incorporates the cited two websites. Perhaps. But that's much different than a constitutional standard on what this court is going to look to. We have no notice of this.
So that you would agree that the statute could be validly applied to an ad that says, look at this website, and the website then uses the magic words.
Perhaps. I'm not certain of that, and I'm sorry that I don't have a considered response to that question. But that is much different than what we are faced with. We're faced with ad hoc criteria that is being used by the government. They reject examining subjective intent because it's unworkable. Now they want to examine subjective intent. They disclaim to this court and Justice Scalia's question about, well, anything that might influence an election, can we regulate it? They said no. Well, now they are claiming that. That anything that might influence an
election. Would you agree that the First Amendment would not be violated by an ad that was the functional equivalent of one that contained magic words?
Well, I disagree with that holding of the McConnell.
Why should there be a constitutional difference between two ads that convey the same message?
Well, I don't believe they have
the
same message.
If functional equivalent, by hypothesis, they convey the same message.
Well, Your Honor, I lost that argument in this court. So, I'm not trying to relitigate McConnell. I'm trying to give meaning to McConnell. I mean, you talked about genuine issue ads. This court did. Their experts identified genuine issue ads. They said, and this court said, in Wisconsin Right to Life 1, as-applied challenges can be brought. And so we're trying to give meaning to that.
Would the ad itself on the website, in your opinion, have been okay? You turn to the website 3 months before the election. It says 16 times out of 16 in the past 2 years, Feingold and Cole have voted to filibuster certain of the president's nominees. Feingold and Cole are putting politics into the court system, creating gridlock and costing taxpayers money. Now, 3 months before the election, you put right that in your ad. Now, is that, in your opinion, constitutionally protected, gets it out of McCain-Feingold?
As a broadcast ad?
Yeah.
Misunderstood.
Yeah. I mean, what you did, suppose, instead of what you ran,
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, because
you think that is protected?
Yes, because whether you praise or criticize a government official's action in office has nothing to do with whether it falls under First Amendment's protection of petitioning. In fact, that's the kind of information we didn't do that, but that's not. But that's the kind of information that's very relevant to the constituents' effort to petition.
Thank you, Mr. Bopp. General Clement, you have 2 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Just a few points in rebuttal. First, I'd like to stress the virtue of as-applied challenges. You might wonder in the abstract, well, isn't there a problem with the statute that applies to a group that's running a series of ads and then one of them falls in the period? But then you look in an as-applied challenge and you see that didn't happen here. In fact, the opposite did. This issue was percolating since March of 2003. These ads were run some 500 days after the first filibuster vote. Both before and after Senator Feingold's reelection cycle, they addressed this issue.
Does that go to their meaning or to the intent of — is that what governs? It's the intent of the person who puts it on? I thought you were focusing on the meaning of it, what it conveys to the public.
Justice Scalia, if you're looking for an as-applied challenge that's going to identify a genuine issue ad, I would think that it would go somewhat to intent. And I would think reason that the repeated
ads — That's new to me. I thought you were asking us to look at the meaning. What does it mean to the
No, our position is slightly different than interveners on that point. And I think the reason that the series of ads hypothetical is beguiling is because it suggests that because they run the same issue ad all the time, they must be interested in the issue, not the election. And the opposite is true here. They run ads about this issue. They have communications about this issue outside of the period of Senator Feingold's reelection. They don't rely on broadcast ads. They rely on e-alerts when it's not during the election cycle. But when it's during the election cycle, all of a sudden they start running broadcast ads. And I think it shows what the timing suggests, that the timing here suggests an intent to influence the election, not an intent to engage on the issue.
How long will the blackout period be during the upcoming year for the presidential candidates?
Well, I think that in various places it will be 30 days before the primary and then obviously 60 days before the general.
It could be as long as 200 days. Isn't that correct?
Not in any one place. And if there's an argument, though, that because of the way that various, you know, broadcast media affect Manchester, New Hampshire, that's a great as-applied challenge. The virtue of as-applied challenges are that you get a concrete record. And you don't have to speculate, wow, you know, is it possible to address the filibuster
issue? You have to speculate before you try to put the ad on.
No,
you have to speculate whether the court is going to say, well, since you're in the zone of three different radio stations or television stations, a different rule applies. Doesn't the person who wants to speak have to speculate?
No.
Roll the dice?
No, they don't, Justice Scalia. And one of the arguments that's made to try to suggest that there should be a reconsideration of McConnell is as-applied challenges don't work. How can he say that? In the two cases that have been brought, there were preliminary injunction proceedings that were completed before the blackout period began. So in that case, bring your preliminary injunction if you have a question. But the virtue of as-applied challenges, and the last thing I'll say, is the virtue of as-applied challenges, they're not all created equal. Just because this as-applied challenge fails doesn't mean the statute isn't open to them. Thank you.
Thank you, General. The case is submitted.